The protests of the workers this time were based on the lack of sanitary facilities in their living quarters, the non-existence of medical services, and terrible working conditions. They stated furthermore that they were not being paid in real money, but in scrip, which was good only to buy Virginia ham in the company commissaries. José Arcadio II was put in jail because he revealed that the scrip system was a way for the company to finance its fruit ships, which without the commissary merchandise would have to return empty from New Orleans to the banana ports. The other complaints were common knowledge. The company physicians did not examine the sick, but had them line up behind one another in the dispensaries, and a nurse would put a pill the color of copper sulfate on their tongues, whether they had malaria, gonorrhea, or constipation. It was a cure that was so common that children would stand in line several times, and instead of swallowing the pills, would take them home to use as bingo markers. The company workers were crowded together in miserable barracks. The engineers, instead of putting in toilets, had a portable latrine for every 50 people brought to the camps at Christmas time, and they held public demonstrations of how to use them so that they would last longer. The decrepit lawyers dressed in black, who during other times had besieged Colonel Aureliano Buendía, and who now were controlled by the banana company, dismissed those demands with decisions that seemed like acts of magic. When the workers drew up a list of unanimous petitions, a long time passed before they were able to notify the banana company officially. As soon as he found out about the agreement, Mr. Brown hitched his luxurious glassed-in coach to the train and disappeared from Macondo, along with the more prominent representatives of his company. Nonetheless, some workers found one of them the following Saturday in a brothel, and they made him sign a copy of the sheet with the demands while he was naked with the women who had helped to entrap him. The mournful lawyers showed in court that the man had nothing to do with the company, and in order that no one doubt their arguments, they had him jailed as an impostor. Later on, Mr. Brown was surprised traveling incognito in a third-class coach, and they made him sign another copy of the demands. On the following day, he appeared before the judges with his hair dyed black and speaking flawless Spanish. The lawyers showed that the man was not Mr. Jack Brown, the superintendent of the banana company, born in Prattville, Alabama, but a harmless vendor of medicinal plants, born in Macondo, and baptized there with the name of Dagoberto Fonseca. A while later, faced with a new attempt by the workers, the lawyers publicly exhibited Mr. Brown's death certificate, attested to by consuls and foreign ministers, which bore witness that on June 9th last, he had been run over by a fire engine in Chicago. Tired of that hermeneutical delirium, the workers turned away from the authorities in Macondo and brought their complaints up to the higher courts. It was there that the sleight-of-hand lawyers proved that the demands lacked all validity for the simple reason that the banana company did not have, never had had, and never would have, any workers in its service, because they were all hired on a temporary and occasional basis. So that the fable of the Virginia ham was nonsense, the same as that of the miraculous pills and the Yuletide toilets. And by a decision of the court it was established and set down in solemn decrees that the workers did not exist. The great strike broke out. Cultivation stopped halfway, the fruit rotted on the trees, and the 120-car trains remained on the sidings. The idle workers overflowed the towns. The street of the Turks echoed with a Saturday that lasted for several days, and in the pool room at the Hotel Jacob, they had to arrange 24-hour shifts. That was where José Arcadio II was on the day it was announced that the army had been assigned to reestablish public order. Although he was not a man given to omens, the news was like an announcement of death that he had been waiting for ever since that distant morning when Colonel Gerineldo Márquez had let him see an execution. The bad omen did not change his solemnity, however. He took the shot he had planned, and it was good. A short time later, the drumbeats, the shrill of the bugle, the shouting and running of the people, told him that not only had the game of pool come to an end, but also the silent and solitary game that he had been playing with himself ever since that dawn execution. Then he went out into the street and saw them. There were three regiments whose march in time to a galley drum made the earth tremble. Their snorting of a many-headed dragon filled the glow of noon with a pestilential vapor. They were short, stocky, and brute-like. They perspired with the sweat of a horse, and had a smell of suntanned hide, and the taciturn and impenetrable perseverance of men from the uplands. Although it took them over an hour to pass by, one might have thought that they were only a few squads marching in a circle, because they were all identical, sons of the same bitch, and with the same stolidity they all bore the weight of their packs and canteens, the shame of their rifles with fixed bayonets, and the chancre of blind obedience and a sense of honor.